Hello, everyone. I just wanted to welcome you to Get Minted, our mint condition podcast here, where we inspire people to live a life of purpose. Today, we actually have a special guest here. His name is Lucas Lovelace. Lucas, just want to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. And Lucas is actually an executive chef, a culinary chef. So we're going to talk a little bit about food today. Lucas, how did you actually get into the culinary world?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I kind of looked at cooking, something that I was so passionate about, trying to follow my passions. And I was thinking, so what's next? And I thought, you know, I need to go to culinary school. So I moved to San Francisco to the Tenderloin, which is a great name for a culinary school, if you think about it, because Tenderloin speaks of the filet mignon cut of meat, where we get the filet from. So I went to the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco. And I've talked to chefs. One of my chefs who went to the same school that I met in New York, he'd say one of the interesting things about culinary school is they teach you everything except how to cook. So it was a great experience, but also you're learning things that maybe like were relevant 80 years ago, or maybe like they were really big before the Nouvelle Cuisine, or maybe even you go to a school that has like modernist techniques, but it's not necessarily, there's not a focus on flavor in culinary school. They kind of teach you how to run a successful business, about other things that they think are relevant. But culinary school for me was a great platform so that I can make a jump off to New York, which is where my real culinary school was.
Okay. So what was your experience in restaurants out in New York?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. At that point, when I first moved to New York, I got this dream to be a private chef. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I wasn't ready to do it yet. And I needed to keep looking. So after Oceana, I was like, where can I go from here? And I was like, I turned my attention towards seafood, so I'm going to turn my attention towards meat now. So I left there to work at a top 10 restaurant in New York. It's called Restaurant Guild. They took the site of the Cirque 2000, and it was just a great experience. And then after that, I was like, okay, what's next? You know, if you want to understand cuisine and how to become better. So one of my friends reached out to me who was working for New York Magazine, had just put the best restaurant in New York. And it was a chef by the name of John George on the cover. So after 2 years at Oceana, 2 years at Guild, I left to go work for John George at his flagship restaurant in Columbus Circle. And it's incredible too. Like, mastery is such a fascinating topic, because other chefs that you can work for, especially in culinary school, there's people where you can spend hours just working on a single dish. One thing that John George does that's so brilliant, and this guy, so much can be traced back to him. Some people think he's the best chef in the world. The term fusion can be argued to go back to him. Chocolate molten cakes that you see like at the Cheesecake Factory, It can be argued that he's the first person to do that. So instead of spending hours to create a dish, he could create a really flavorful dish in 20 minutes.
Oh, nice. And yeah, and I think what a lot of times we're thinking flavorful dishes takes a tremendous amount of time. And I think that's one of the fears that's out there in terms of cooking. You know, and you mentioned in terms of just kind of learning with the experience of flavor and it doesn't have to take a long time. But you also mentioned that there was a desire to be more in the private sector, private chef.
That's a great question. I think the biggest difference is the specialized experience for the customer. So in a restaurant, you don't know who's going to come in. You have your reservations on the books and you know people's restrictions, but you don't necessarily know their preferences. But as a private chef, you get to know your client's palate, and you cook just for that palate or their friends when they come over. So you're constantly trying to figure out how to make a better end product for that one individual, which is incredible.
Yeah, that's yeah. And I think everyone's palates are a little bit different as well. So understanding what their needs are and what their desires are. At what point did you actually finally say, you know what, I made it. I got to where I want to be doing more of the along the lines of being a private chef versus working at a restaurant?
Yeah, you know, that happened. I had started cooking for a guy who was one of the founders of PayPal. He was the first guy to invest in Facebook, and everyone knows who he is pretty much in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So he relocated me and my family back out to San Francisco to be his full-time chef, which is a very interesting position. I can get into some of the details a little bit without violating my NDA. But when the producers from Top Chef reached out to me to go onto the show, and I turned them down because it was like, not what can I gain, but what can I lose? I felt like that was the moment that I really experienced that.
Oh, that's great. And well, for all of us, you know, food is definitely one of two things. One is you're eating to fuel your body, or you're eating to really enjoy the flavors and the taste in terms of what is being made. I'm the latter. I like food. So I enjoy the flavors that are out there. And so when you're talking about, you know, being a private chef to someone, I would imagine that a lot of these individuals actually have very specific needs or very specific requirements that they're looking at. And being able to meet the requirements is one thing, but using the culinary skills that have developed to create flavors that are enjoyable is another. Or would you say that kind of intertwines with each other?
Yeah, I'd say they definitely intertwine.
Okay. Yeah. And with that, you know, what are some things that you would say is key to making anything flavorful and nutritious at the same time?
So I think flavor boils down to three things. I think the first one is inspiration / starting point. Mm-hmm. I think second, flavor is having great ingredients. And then number three, I think flavor is, does it pop? When I say number one, inspiration / starting point, and I think this is really relevant too, because this isn't necessarily for restaurant chefs, but for the home cook, mm-hmm. all different skill levels too, different cooking maturity levels. I think a lot of people don't realize it, but there's great people who have shared their thoughts, their approach to cooking, such as Dory Greenspan's great. John George has some really great ideas for home cooks. There's a person named Jennifer Siegel. So I think if you can have a great starting point, like a great recipe, a great cookbook, then you start to go to the flavor gold mine, if you would. It is a process too. David Kinch from Manresa in downtown Las Gatas, the only three Michelin star restaurant down there that I know of, last time I checked, he talks about the pursuit of mastery. And I think you could make this relevant to flavor too, that it's three things. It's imitation, assimilation, and innovation. So whenever we're trying to, you know, improve whatever it is that we do in anything that we're doing, you know, you want to find a master and you want to try to get inside their minds. So that's where imitation comes in. And then as you're inside their mind, you're you know, making this recipe, that recipe, you start to realize why they're choosing that ingredient instead of that one. And then you start to have your own thoughts, you know, you begin to assimilate it. And then from there, you have such a great foundation underneath your feet that you're able to innovate. And I think that's the first starting point in pursuit of flavor. I think the second, you know, relevant fact, if you're trying to chase flavor, is we all know this one, it's great ingredients. So we all know, you know, like this isn't something that isn't widespread knowledge, that great meals are made with great ingredients, you know, organic food. Some people talk about eating the rainbow, which I think is probably a pretty good rule of thumb. If you watch Top Chef, the cooking competition, they always drop those guys off inside of a Whole Foods. And it's because the ingredients there are good. And when it's time for a judge's table, their dishes are going to be able to stand up under scrutiny. Mm-hmm. That being said, though, there are limitations to the greatness of ingredients that we can source. Like, where are you going to get incredible seafood? We know, like, the area that we live in, Saratoga Meat and Fish, has really great grass-fed steaks. But what if you want to get black bass or caviar? What if you're interested in game or foie gras? What if you want black or white truffles? Like, the list goes on and on and on. There's a gentleman whose name is Rod Brown. He was a marine biology student in the 1970s, right when this chef from France, a guy that changed American cuisine forever, his name's Jean-Louis Paladin. Jean-Louis, he moved to Washington, D.C., and he was so frustrated because in France, everyone works together. You know, the butcher works with the baker, who works with the farmer, who works with a vintner. And there's this collaboration that was happening. And in America, up until that time, that just wasn't happening. So he crossed paths with Rod Brown, who convinced him to put on a wetsuit and go dive for diver sea scallops for him. And the scallops that he brought were so good. Right before he'd slice them for his clients, for say he was making a scallop carpaccio, the scallop would quiver just because the caliber of the ingredient.
Oh, wow.
And so from there, Rod Brown, just, he revolutionized seafood, what you can order with this guy, John Louis. So today you can get, you know, all those seafood items that I talked about, some of the best seafood in the world, by reaching out to Brown Trading Company. You can get foie, you can get duck, you can get wild game if you reach out to D'Artagnan. Or you could contact a company that's located in Huron, Ohio, and you can get these incredible finishing touches for your holiday dishes if you really want to just blow your guests away, mm-hmm. from a farm that's called the Chef's Garden, where not only do they have like these really incredible flowers and colors, but you think, oh, you're eating a sprig of dill on the dish, and actually it's like mini licorice. Just take all these really interesting ingredients that really elevates. And the last thing that I'd say, the last component of flavor is pop. Does the dish pop? You know, and this is, for me, popping is sort of like flavor and deliciousness. Like, what does that mean? Like, it just seems like it could become abstract as well.
Sure.
I would say, to understand pop, you could say like, it shares characteristics with flavor. You could say it's that wow. You could say it's sort of that otherworldliness. You could say it's sort of like going to Great America, but inside your mouth. So if you say you're going on the Grizzly at Great America, you know, mm-hmm. it's a rackety old roller coaster, and you start to slowly go up, and you don't know if the roller coaster is going to collapse under you. Because that's just the way I feel, maybe.
Yeah.
But you know, something's about to happen, right?
Yep.
And then you get to the threshold, and you just go down, and then you whip around, you go up, you go down, you don't know what's going to happen next. To a certain degree, that's what pop is. I think that pop is seven different components to it. And this is very simplistic, very boiled down, but I think this is really relevant. And I wish someone had told me these things, especially before I went through the entire process that I went through, just when I was trying to create dishes at my house. So if I can remember them all correctly, and this is my own definition, every chef has their own take probably. I think pop is the presence of acid. It's the presence of texture. It's the presence of freshness. It's spice. It's hot. It's umami. And it's one other thing that I'm not recalling right this second, but I will, because each of those just need like to be touched upon very briefly. So when I say acid, what I mean is, a splash of vinegar, a teaspoon of lemon juice, lime juice, probably more than that, champagne vinegar, balsamic, takes a dish that's one-dimensional and it becomes multidimensional. So it enlivens everything. Second, texture. Texture just breaks up the monotony in a dish. Like a bag of Lay's potato chips, it makes you want to have more than just one bite. It stimulates your appetite. So you want to keep eating whatever's in front of you. You're like, whoa, that's so good. And this isn't even processed. Number three, freshness. Freshness for me, like, I feel like that can be delivered with herbs. Think parsley, cilantro, things that are sliced with a sharp knife, which is very important. Spices. If you don't just use powdered spices, but you have a coffee grinder in your house and you zap it, and you use freshly ground spices, that takes your dish to a whole nother dimension. Another thing is the presence of heat. Heat, I don't mean like so hot like you're eating a habanero, just it's barely discernible, but it kind of causes you to go up a little bit on the roller coaster. The one of the seven that I forgot when I was sharing that just now is smokiness. Smokiness, think like paprika is a spice, but it also doubles as smokiness if it's smoked paprika. It's just one more element of taste. And then the last one is umami. And that's the one that's difficult to put your finger on because you don't necessarily know what it's doing or what it's contributing. It's more like a secret agent or like a really good point guard that just causes everything that's in the dish to become elevated. So dishes that are high in umami are like Parmesan, dried mushrooms, miso. These are things that just cause your dish to be that much more delicious, which is what I think we're looking for.
Yeah, it's and I think that, you know, definitely breaking it down from that standpoint, you know, a lot of times we probably have experienced some of those, but we just don't know how to express it in that manner. But you know what you mentioned, that the first starting point is imitation. So for the home chefs out there, who doesn't really know where to kind of get inspired, what would be some good options for them to kind of see where that imitation can come from?
Great question. So Home Cooking with John George, mm-hmm. it's a blue cookbook. It's great. Anything from Dory Greenspan through these cookbooks, great. Martha Stewart is good. Barefoot Contessa is also really good. I think a fascinating idea, and I did this earlier in my career when I first became a private chef, is to find one person that is just, you know, that they're good. Mm-hmm. And then just cause that person to be the theme through which you make your meals for the month. So maybe that person's into Mediterranean spices or things like that. You're constantly turning your attention to that person and imitating them.
And those are some great suggestions, and I'm going to have to look up a couple of those myself. Now, you also talked about good ingredients that can really pop and stand out. For that, does better ingredients necessarily mean that you have to spend more in terms of just picking the ingredients? So maybe a better way of putting it is, can you still have a great tasting meal on a budget?
You can, but it's difficult. Okay. Because usually you get what you pay for.
So organic is always recommended.
Organic is recommended. And I do feel like since Amazon purchased Whole Foods, mm-hmm. that their prices, they're no longer whole paycheck like everyone used to refer to them in the past. Sure. And then it's also not whole day to shop anymore. Because I know Amazon changed their policy now. If you want to get your groceries delivered through Whole Foods, it's $9.95. But still, that's like an hour that you're going to shred from your day.
Sure. And you mentioned some really key places in terms of, just like butcher shops and seafood places and all that. So for someone who doesn't have access to a good butcher shop or doesn't have access to good seafood, are there some tips or tricks of the trade that you can that you would say it's good for someone just going to a local supermarket where they can choose maybe better fish or better meats and that sort?
Yeah, I would not buy fish from Whole Foods. I hate to say it, but I think Lunardi's is good. Mm-hmm. Even Costco is good, and you know that whatever their price is, it's going to be the best.
Yeah, so that's great. So Costco is a good option.
It's a good option.
Yeah. And what about simple, you shared a lot of information in terms of how to really make a great nutritious meal, a healthy meal or a healthy dish taste great. Is there a holiday favorite or is there a favorite dish that you would typically like to make during the holidays that you can maybe share with everybody?
Yeah, one of the dishes that we're doing a lot, we're really busy right now. But we start a lot of our dinners with a salad. I feel like it sums up the seven components of popping. Mm-hmm. And that's a dish we have it on our website. There's a photo of it. It's called the Bounty of the Farmer's Market Salad. And one thing that's really cool about it is that it's very seasonal, with the name Bounty of the Farmer's Market. So whatever is just delicious right now. So right now, like blood oranges, caracaras, radicchio, kumquats, kale, kohlrabi, parsnips, celery root, chicories. Those are great ingredients that are seasonal and they plug into a salad very well. So the salad, it has acid with the vinaigrette that we serve, that the oil that we use is MCT oil, which won't be GMO, which is something that I think is worth being on the lookout against. Sure. And it's, I think it's more nutritional. So it has one pop with the acid, two, it has texture with granola, which we use coconut oil for. And instead of using sugar, I try to use maple syrup. Mm-hmm. Number three, it has freshness with all kinds of herbs inside of it. Four, it has spice. We do, a little bit of paprika. We have smoke with the sriracha. We have umami with shredded Parmesan on top. And then another thing that I didn't discuss, but I think it's important, especially when you're having people come over to your guest, people come over to your house, you have guests coming. And even more so if you're doing it professionally like we're doing, is it's important to have a wow factor. So we try to make dishes that are as beautiful as they are delicious and just interesting. So we take an avocado and we cut it in half, take the seed out, peel the flesh off around it, slice the bottom of it, then use a ring mold and make it perfectly cylindrical and use that to hold the salad dressing. So it also becomes interactive. So you slice into the avocado and everyone in a sense gets to garnish their own salad, dress their own salad, I mean, as the dressing just kind of oozes into the rest of the dish.
Wow, that's a great little tip. I'm gonna have to try that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's amazing. So on a salad, and it sounds like best choice in terms of the dressing would be more of a balsamic with an oil versus some of the other types of dressings that are out there. Brings out more to flavor.
I do like the oil and vinegar dressings. The combinations are virtually limitless. There's so many different things you can do.
That's great. Now, what if you're not a cook and you're just trying to figure out how to make something here? Does cooking good food and having great flavor require a lot of effort?
It depends on the recipe.
Yeah,
that's where knowledge is power. The more knowledge you have, like John George, the more you can whip something up in 20 minutes. So I think that goes back to the imitation.
The imitation.
Yeah.
So for anybody who's just starting off and just trying to figure things out, take a recipe that works from somebody else and then over time make it your own. It sounds like it would be a good way to go.
That's right. And those people that I mentioned, they don't make you spend all day inside the kitchen to come up with great flavor.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's definitely definitely helps anybody who's out there trying to figure out what to do with food. And as we heard from you, is that flavors themselves, it's individualized in terms of each person's palate, but good flavors or flavors that really pop really comes from good ingredients, and the seven factors that you're talking about that makes it stand out, right?
It seems like a lot, right?
Yeah. But I'm sure a lot of it we've already kind of incorporate ourselves already. Just kind of now, it's just a matter of applying that in a manner that suits us best, yeah, in terms of what we enjoy. Now, what about for the individuals out there that have very special nutritional needs? As an example, if someone's gluten free or has an issue with dairy. What are some suggestions for that?
Gluten-free, there's a great flour out there called Cup for Cup from Thomas Keller. Out of all the flours on the market, it's the least chalky. So that's what I would recommend for them. Someone that's dairy-free, it just depends what type, what are you trying to accomplish?
If someone's making like a chowder or let's say like a bisque and they can't use any dairy products, is there a difference between almond milk, oat milk, soy milk? I don't know what else there is in terms of using one of the substitutes.
Yeah, what I do is I would just use whatever flours, I mean, whatever type of milk is the most subtle.
Okay.
So I wouldn't use like the Thai brand coconut milk, which is really fatty. You know, it solidifies when you put it in the fridge. A lot of the times when it's room temperature, it's solid. Just because the flavor, it's going to really taste like coconut milk. I would probably use one of the more subtle companies. You want to taste them. I think So Delicious makes a good brand just because it's so subtle. And then I would want to, if I was doing it, I would dial up the other ingredients. I would make it, I would use the milk just for the color in the chowder.
Got it.
But then I would amp up the clam stock. And I would make the clam stock super clammy. And then whatever else, you know, I would intensify the presence of bacon and I'd want to try to overwhelm whatever that thing is that I was trying to overcome.
So basically almost like overshadowing the flavors that you would get from some of those, just because of the flavors on the versus dairy is a little bit more significant or noticeable.
Correct.
Okay. And what about, you know, it's during the holiday seasons where there's a guilty pleasure in terms of sweets for a lot of people. And if you're diabetic or if you have an issue with processed sugars, what are some alternatives that you can kind of do with that?
I think this there's two sides to this question. I think one side is the personal preference. Mm-hmm. When you taste the different types of sugar substitutes out there, how do you like them? Do you like the xylitol? Does that taste good to you? Because they do kind of taste a little manufactured to me. Do you like the erythritol? Whatever it is, I think there's some interesting studies out there where some people are saying, you know, watch out for these sugar substitutes in your microbiome. We don't know necessarily if they take away from that robust microbial environment inside of us. So I think that's one thing to think about. Mm-hmm. I do think that stevia leaf is probably the best of them. To me, it just has the best mouthfeel. It tastes the least artificial to me. Mm-hmm. I do think also another thing to think about is, do you want to use sugar? Do you have to use it? Because there's ways that you can dial up the natural sweetness inside of ingredients. So like, instead of just doing a full-on baked dessert or something with chocolate, you could go the fruit route and you can unlock more sugars without adding more to it by the presence of heat, really, caramelization or just gently heating something.
So definitely like maybe in terms of if you have a sweet craving, go for more fruit base or create something more with the fruits versus something that's just going to require more to refine sugar and that sort.
I think so. You know what? I had a client who for about a year there, I didn't make one dessert for them. Mm-hmm. All the dessert every single day. And when I say dessert, I mean like you're going to have like a sugar crash after. The dessert for the year was fresh fruit, no sugar. And so we just rotated all the different combinations of fruits, heating them up, playing with them, adding texture to it. Maybe I'd scrape vanilla beans and just, I never repeated the dessert once. There were just so many different combinations that you could always do something different.
That's great. You know, if you're talking about, you know, there's so many people out there that actually has a love for food. I think the vast majority of us actually has a love for food. And really the draw to food is taste, as we've been talking about here. If there's one advice that you can give everybody out there, what is the one advice that you would give that in regards to eating healthy and still being able to enjoy the flavors and the taste in terms of the foods that they're actually having? What's the one advice that you would say is the best?
I'd say it's difficult. And I'd say it's difficult because we work all day. Mm-hmm. We come home and we're exhausted and we want to just call Five Guys and have them deliver some Cajun fries and like a two patty burger with fake cheese on it, lettuce wrap, so I feel better. So I hate to say it, but it takes sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to cut corners.
Sure.
You know, like whenever we cut corners, the nutritional value is going to be diminished. And you want to cook things as quickly as you get them.
Yeah. That's great advice. You know, it's definitely, if it's something that we really love and something that we enjoy, we do have to devote a little time to it. We have to devote a little time, but the return is going to put a smile on our face, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at least put a smile on your biceps.
Yeah. And your stomach, of course.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, Lucas, I appreciate all the information that you just shared. I appreciate just you sharing your journey in terms of where you started and how you've kind of gone into the culinary arts. And I just hope that all of our listeners out there are able to take some of the information that you have provided and allow them to explore a little bit more in terms of creating some more fascinating dishes that really can give them that pop factor and maybe a little bit of silence during a dinner because everyone's enjoying their meal so much. And if anybody's looking for your services, obviously you do, you're a private chef at this point. If anybody's looking for your services and would love to be able to kind of get a hold of you and find out more about you and how maybe they're looking to bring someone on and create some dishes for them or some meals for them, how could they actually reach you?
Best way to get in contact is just to go to my website, llchefservices.com.
Okay. We'll make sure that we'll put that into our podcast and we'll spell that out as well. So for all of you who is looking for an excellent private chef, anybody who's definitely well averse in terms of making meals and accommodate whatever your needs might be in terms of special needs as well as creating some interesting dishes that will appease you as well as maybe your guests. We'd love for you to actually contact Lucas here and have him come out and see you. Well, Lucas, I appreciate your time and appreciate everything that you've shared with us on this podcast.
I appreciate it, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Thank you.